This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome back to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back. What are we talking about today?
Well, today we're going to innovate. We're going to try something new, audience. Okay. We're going to have a two-part. Yeah. First, we're going to talk about the new Tesla truck launch. And then we're going to invite a guest in. We're going to invite Regan Davis from STEP. And he's going to make the case for hiring Canadian firms and in this challenging
time. In the oil field service sector.
Yes. Yeah.
Good. Well, I'm excited to talk about the new Tesla Cybertruck. It actually came out a few weeks ago. But it is a very unique looking vehicle. And the video is just a must-see video.
I have to say that, like, I followed some of the news releases and then I took the time to actually see the whole video. I think it's not that long, 45 minutes or an hour or something, but it's pretty entertaining and just shows what a showman Elon Musk is, right? It's just a total show.
Well, it's a total show, and the vehicle is extreme in its looks, its performance, and we'll talk a little bit about the performance here in a few minutes, but I argue that that's what you need. And of course, I am an unabashed Tesla fan. I drive one, driven one for over 3 years. I think they're really amazing vehicles. But to break into a market like the pickup truck market, you have to come out swinging, literally. And there's some guy with a sledgehammer that took a thing to the stainless steel, what is it, an exoskeleton?
Yes, an exoskeleton.
So it doesn't actually have a frame.
The name is different. Yeah. Cybertruck, I think that quite suits it. And yeah, it doesn't have a frame and it uses the same, they called it a skin, just like airplanes have a skin.
Right.
But it uses the same special alloy, which is from stainless steel, but maybe a little different, that they're using to make the spaceships out of. So that's pretty exciting. Yeah. You can have a truck made out of something that goes to space.
Well, it looks like a stealth bomber. And I think that's important because anything that you want to introduce into this world's extremely competitive market has to be different. And I think that the look of the truck is a love it or hate it kind of thing. The initial orders would speak to 250,000 people, I think. That's what they, at last count that I saw, have actually put an order down for the thing. So I think that that's what you need. I think that's historically, if you look at innovators, that is the formula for introducing something radically new.
Well, and that got me thinking. So I just had listened to your story on your new Energy File project site. You had a story about Max Vallier, who had the same sort of personality, and he was promoting a rocket-powered car at the time.
Max Vallier in the 1920s, he's an Austrian physicist, but also very much a showman, infatuated with space travel, going to Mars, that kind of thing. Even written books on space travel, but he also took rocket power technology and put it into vehicles to show people on Earth the potential of what a rocket can do. And in many ways, that type of showmanship is very essential, I would argue, for people to introduce new kinds of products. You have to not just introduce a new product, you have to introduce a dream, and you have to demonstrate the dream today, your future vision for what the world is going to look like. And I think that Elon Musk and this truck is very much in line with that type of thing. We've seen it with great innovators where they have larger than life personalities, Thomas Edison, even Steve Jobs, others that we can point to who have really introduced products that have changed the world.
Well, and Steve Jobs, I think most of us remember him, right? Yeah, every time there was a new iPhone, there was this huge show and he had his black turtleneck on. And I know Elon Musk had the black leather coat look, right? Yeah. They got to have that look. But talk a little bit about Thomas Edison because you had mentioned that in the audio story, which, by the way, we'll put a link to the audio story about Max Vallier, which is on the Energy File site right now. Really worth a listen to, especially because there's so many parallels to this truck launch. But talk us a little bit about Thomas Edison, because I didn't know he was a showman as well.
Well, he was very much a showman. I mean, he introduced so many history-changing devices, the record player for audio, the stock ticker machine, movies, the list goes on and on.
He introduced
the
movies?
Light bulb.
I really just knew him for the light bulb.
Oh, no. Yeah. There's just an incredible long list of products and patents. And so he was a master at unveiling things. He was a master of show and being in the media. And so in the story, which, by the way, you can, we'll put the link. Thank you very much, Jackie. But we'll also direct people to www.energyfile.com. P-H-I-L-E, energyfile.org, where people can listen to the story of Max Vallier, a larger-than-life individual And there's an interesting lesson. It's about a 15-minute listen. It was recorded here locally at Ear Candy Studios. And I love the sound effects that that have been put into this one. It's one of my favorite stories. I'll be releasing 10 stories as part of a compilation of short stories. And Rocket Man, the story of Max, is one of them.
Okay. And I definitely recommend listening to it in the context of this truck launch.
But it goes to show you sort of the lengths to which showmanship is used either to introduce a new product or to disparage a competitor's product. And it's really important because if you just come out with Me Too products that are not overly different from anything else out there and don't have a little bit of pizzazz, as I said, in this uber competitive world, I don't think you're going to get very far. And we are trying to change the world in many ways going forward. And so I argue that Elon Musk's personality, whether you love him or hate him, is ideally suited for this sort of thing. And the truck is something that exemplifies that. So back to the stats on the truck.
Well, I just want to talk about the show a little bit because I did think the show was pretty funny.
Yeah.
And, you know, the video.
Yeah.
You said to show that you're better than your competitors. So they had this like tug of war with F-150.
Yeah.
And it basically, his new truck just basically pulled that F-150 like it was a little toy. Now, Ford has come out and said that wasn't quite fair because he had a four-wheel drive and they chose a Ford that had a two-wheel drive and they want to have a fair comparison. But, you know, that controversy created a lot of publicity. And then this whole hitting the glass. Now, I don't know why you would need like bulletproof glass for your truck.
It's product differentiation feeding into a certain psychology of that market segment, right? Or a subsegment that, you know, the buyers of the truck want something really different, very, I'll say it, macho.
Yeah.
And it works.
Like a tank.
It works. It's basically an electric Hummer. That's designed like a stealth bomber.
Yeah, right? And Hummer, but you don't have the GHG emissions.
We won't talk about what goes into making the thing, but that's it in terms of a product launch. Highly successful, 250,000 orders. I mean, if you get 20,000 for a run of a car, that's considered successful. I mean, contrast that with the Mustang electric vehicle that was just released. Okay, I mean, it's a decent looking car, but does it look any different, really, from anything else? Looks like a little crossover SUV thing. Like,
that's true. You want to differentiate yourself.
Yeah.
I also thought the accident that happened, right? They threw this metal ball at the windshield and it broke. I was actually thinking after, that was actually kind of brilliant because it got way more media coverage.
Well, no news is bad news.
Right? Yeah. You know, everybody probably globally that is connected to the internet knew about the mistake. If that hadn't happened, maybe it wouldn't have got the same level of publicity.
Yeah, but I want to get back to the performance because I don't think that a gasoline-powered truck, Ford F-150 or otherwise, would win that battle with an electric truck like this one because the torque of an electric motor and that mega battery that must be in that thing, there's just no way.
Well, and we don't know what the weight of the vehicle will be, but it was amazing when he announced the range. You know, he was saying it would be different levels of range, but everything from 250 miles to 500 miles. Mm-hmm. And 500 miles, I looked up online, depending on, you know, the F-150, which you choose, some are in that range of 500 to 600 miles between having to fill up your tank. So I was really surprised that they would get that type of range.
Well, as an electric vehicle driver, as I said, with over 3 years, I can tell you that those numbers are idealistic. And it's not just Tesla. It's any of these manufacturers that come out with these numbers. I mean, these are like that 500 miles, you could probably multiply it by 0.75 or 0.8 in real life driving conditions. Mm-hmm. So let's just call it 400 for the high end one. That's the one that also apparently has three electric motors and can go 0 to 60 in 2.9 seconds.
Okay. Do you think truck drivers really need that? Like that type of pickup?
No, but do you really need stainless steel skin that's bulletproof? I don't know.
Depends what neighborhood you live in, I guess. But the 500 miles is incredible. The other interesting thing was the price.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's a couple years off, and I don't know if he can do it, but he's basically saying a starting price, this is U.S. dollars, from $39,000 to around $70,000, which is kind of the same range as the F-150, the big, you know, the world's best-selling truck.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's got to be price parity. Otherwise, it's not going to sell to the mass market. It's
but
just going to be a niche market.
You got stainless steel outer. You got all these batteries. Like, it's really surprised me that they think they can get that price point.
I don't know, but I'm just saying that the company has demonstrated an ability to put up these robotic manufacturing plants, and there's all sorts of new technologies in terms of improving optimization and productivity. So it's possible. I'm more concerned about the curb weight, the weight. I mean, an F-150 comes in, I don't know, sort of mid-range, we 5,000 pounds, 4,500 pounds or something like that. There's no curb weight that is quoted on this thing because I think we know to be able to drive around a stainless steel truck and get that kind of range and performance is going to cost, I'm willing to bet it's going to be like 7,000 pounds or something like that.
Yeah.
It's a heavy beast.
But that comes to how can you do it so cheaply, right? Just, you know, the amount of mass sometimes correlates with price.
Sure, it does.
You know, so we're in the market for looking at something to haul our trailer.
You are.
Yeah. Hmm. And I've been looking at this F-150 because they're going to get an electric hybrid. So it can run electric for a certain number of miles and then the combustion engine kicks in.
How green of you.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking it's the best thing you can do because most of our miles are local in the city and we wouldn't need the combustion engine. But then when we haul the trailer, we've got that. So I was like, hey, maybe this Cybertruck, maybe we wait a couple of years to get the Cybertruck. But then when we get out to Kananaskis or Banff, how do we charge our Cybertruck? You know, that's the problem there.
Yeah, but think of all the looks you're going to get.
That's true. And you know, we could just park it all weekend, make sure we stay at like
one of
those
campsites.
You're
going to make a lot of friends if you have one of those pulling your trailer into Kananaskis.
We will. We'll just have to do short trips to camp.
Right. No, but I mean, I think that the point is taken that in remote areas, there aren't a lot of high voltage plug-ins for this kind of vehicle. And this kind of vehicle, to charge it up is going to take longer than your Model 3 or passenger vehicle. And I think that brings up the point that from a utility perspective, you know, people who use this in construction and oil fields that require a lot of range, there's going to be reticence to buy it. So I think this is more of a vanity truck to start, and its utility will have to be proven out before the construction set is going to buy into it. And we'll see what our guest has to say about it later, because I'm going to ask him that.
Okay. Well, and you know, another interesting thing that Elon said in his pitch was that the capital cost is similar. But you do have, he thought, in the range of $10,000 to $15,000 lower cost when you consider the fact you don't have to have maintenance, that electricity is a lot cheaper than gasoline. And so I thought, well, maybe there's a niche there, like those work trucks that drive around Calgary and other cities that are really small distances that they go, but they do put a lot of kilometers on, and that they could save a lot just in their fuel costs.
I think that's true today in a place like Calgary where our electricity costs are very cheap. But this number they quote is, I mean, to be fair, highly variable on what market you're in. I mean, some states and provinces have very high electricity costs. And so it's not necessarily true that the savings could be that much. Not only that, but I think if we project into the future 5-10 years out, we get more and more electric vehicles. I don't pay road tax on my electricity. Right. You pay road tax when you go to the gas pump, and there's a tax in gasoline that goes towards maintenance of the pavement and building new roads and all that kind of stuff. This is a big issue that is not really being talked about that much. But at some point, we're going to have to figure out, with electric vehicles running around, how they're going to pay their fair share of the roads they drive on, especially when you put something heavy like this on the road, which does impact the longevity of the pavement.
Right. Well, 1-2% of all cars right now are electric. So it's a ways before they become to that level.
1-2% of sales.
1-2% of sales is electric. So it's going to be a while before maybe those pressures come, but they will come, I agree. Mm-hmm. And just as we wrap up the first section of this podcast, we'll just quickly talk about electric car sales. We had talked about it at the end of September in our podcast, and we just wanted to update our listeners. We had said there was kind of 1 month of weak data in terms of sales, not being as high as the previous year. And now we've got 3 months. So July, August, September, globally, we are seeing that sales of EVs are lower than last year. So they're still selling, but not at the same new levels.
So why is that?
We think it's likely due to reduced subsidies in China and the U.S. The Tesla especially has lost some of the subsidies. And also we're just seeing actually light-duty vehicles in general are selling less as well because of the slowing economy.
So there's a slowing down of total vehicles sold. I mean, it's a staggering number globally. I think it's like 90 million, I don't know, 90 to 100 million combustion engine vehicles. So we're seeing a slowdown in the total number of vehicles sold, and therefore there are less electric vehicles being sold as a consequence. But I think the subsidy issue is a big one because when you take the subsidies off, people are not as keen to buy them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we talked about this last time. This is still true. The one car that actually does seem to work is the Model 3 because it is comparable in its cost to some of its comparable combustion engine peers. And that one actually still has very strong sales. And they've been strong the last 3 months as well.
This is the thing is if, you know, you and I have looked at the charts, there's no question the Tesla is almost a cult-like vehicle still. I mean, because of the way it's been promoted, as we talked about earlier, like it's selling a dream and a vision for the future. And the quality of the vehicle, I can tell you, has improved dramatically. But the competitors that are coming into the fray are not selling nearly as well. You also need some kind of pizzazz. So that, like these other vehicles that are coming to market, I mean, they're not bad-looking cars, but they're just lost in the fray of every other vehicle that's out there.
Yeah, they don't give you that. Part of the reason you get the electric cars, you want everyone to know about it. You don't want it just to blend in.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, you know, electric cars from a utility perspective, I'm sold on it, but I'm not sold that everybody else is going to buy one as fast as people think.
Right. Okay. Well, with that discussion, we'll wrap up the first part of our podcast and we'll join you here shortly with our guest, Regan Davis.
Well, let's get back to the oil and gas world, and we're happy to bring to you Mr. Regan Davis. Regan is the Chief Executive Officer of STEP Energy Services, an oilfield service company that's active not only here in Western Canada, but also in the United States. STEP is engaged in the completions business, which means hydraulic fracturing, wireline, and all sorts of things that go on down in the wellbore. So welcome, Regan.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Regan, before we get started, one quick question. Would you buy a Tesla Cybertruck?
I think it's ugly. I just don't think it's macho enough for you. I just think it doesn't capture the style that you might have seen in some of the Tesla cars. I was kind of disappointing that it wasn't a little more catchy.
Okay,
just too different.
If Tesla's listening, that's a market data point for you.
All right. Now, we've already talked on the show before that oilfield service activity is low this year in Canada, down about 30% year on year. An expectation is this could be the same or possibly even a little bit lower next year. Can you tell us a little bit, Regan, about how competitive the market has become because of this lower activity level here in Canada and then maybe in the U.S. as well?
Yeah, certainly. The industry, if we go back to 2014, was building capacity. We had a bit of a slowdown in 2015-16, and as we came out of that, the industry built more capacity. So now that we've rolled into 2019, where the activity levels have slowed down, the industry is just awash with equipment capacity and other capacities that service our clients, resulting in obviously a very competitive pricing environment. We've seen equipment get parked, and most recently, we're starting to see people talk about equipment being either sold out of the country or cut up into pieces. So
it's really round two. I mean, we saw this in 2015. Certainly, first quarter 16 was really, really bad. Really bad. And that marginalized a lot of equipment. There was a lot of stuff going to auction, as you say, being cut up, made into fence posts, whatever. Now, there's another step change happening.
There certainly is, and it's being driven by a few factors. Certainly one is there's just too much capacity, but there's a recognition in certain service segments that some equipment is just becoming technically obsolete or not relevant to the market. So there's companies recognizing that the best solution is to make it disappear from their fleet.
Now, I went to the Permian, as many of our listeners know, earlier this year. And when I stepped off the airplane into the terminal, the first thing I saw was a big sign that said STEP Energy Services. So that made me feel pretty proud to see a Canadian company down there. And at the time, you were hiring. Is the situation kind of similar in the U.S. to Canada in terms of slowdown of activity and these dynamics that we're talking about?
Yes, it is. Kind of similar is a good phrase. Clearly, we have some additional headwinds in Canada that are getting in the way of sort of capital budgets and whatnot. But the U.S. is not immune to this slowdown. And I think this slowdown is being catalyzed by what investors are expecting now from their E&P investments. So the demand for a return for shareholders, the demand for budget discipline, no more growth. We want shareholder return. That is putting a cap on capital budgets. There's no access to equity. There's no access to debt. So that is resulting in a slowdown in activity.
Meanwhile, well, certainly over the last few years, the double whammy is that you and your peers have gotten much more productive and better at what you do.
Yeah.
So a dollar of spending actually goes further in terms of producing an incremental barrel of oil or cubic foot of gas, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you've got the double whammy of you do more with new age equipment and the capital on the demand side has dried up for now.
Very good point. So the efficiencies we've gained through operations and in virtually every segment of the oilfield service business has effectively increased the available capacity. And yeah, that's occurred at a time when in fact demand has declined. So it is kind of a double-edged sword, you bet.
Okay, so we've got a lot lower activity, sort of the lowest levels in arguably several decades, you know, in terms of the number of wells being drilled. And that has implications to Canada, the Western Canadian oil and gas industry. Like, what are you seeing in terms of the implications to skilled levels of people that are leaving and things like that? I won't put words in your mouth.
Yeah.
But, you know, like,
well, I mean, I think it starts with recognizing that a lot of very high quality assets are leaving Canada into the U.S. to try and pursue business opportunities there. But on the people side, we have, I mean, if you look at this downturn, it's well over 5 years now. And we have put our employees, our professionals through quite a cycle. And so we've laid them off, we've hired them back, we've laid them off, we've hired them back. And what we're seeing is there's just tremendous fatigue in the employee base. And they're choosing to pursue opportunities outside the oil and gas industry. And I mean, if we look outside of Alberta, unemployment rates are quite low. So there is opportunities for people who might have come from other parts of Canada
sure.
to work.
I mean, it's very hard on families, we know. Mm-hmm. And after being laid off, go back to work, being laid off, go back to work, people just say, I've had enough. I'm packing up. I'm taking my family. I'm going to go build condominiums in Vancouver or whatever.
Yeah, you bet. You compound that with the lifestyle that our field professionals have to put up with. It doesn't lend itself to a great family life. So the steady income that the oil industry has provided has allowed us to retain people.
So there's a brain drain, but there's also a real knock-on effect on some of the small communities that support the oil and gas industry. You know, the small towns, the Edsons, Rocky Mountain Houses, Drayton Valleys, and so on.
Yeah.
What are you seeing in these small towns?
So there's certain parts that haven't really been hit too much. I mean, I think Grand Prairie still is faring well. But if you get into some of these smaller towns where there's been new hotels built in anticipation of the industry remaining active, there's been other businesses started to sort of support the energy service businesses. You're seeing those businesses close now. You're seeing hotels close, and you're seeing a lot of despair in some of these small communities.
Yeah.
The human side of this downturn is really not well understood.
It's not well understood.
Mm-hmm. And with such a drastic change, you know, we look at the numbers, right? Even last year, we had about $50 billion of spending in the industry. Now it's down to something like $32 billion. That's all money that's just kind of been pulled out of the economy and has implications in terms of a lot less people working. And even those, like you talk about, those spin-off businesses, right? They're not directly oil and gas service companies, but their activity, like the hotels, the restaurants, you know, that goes down as well as there's less work going on.
Yeah, you bet. It has a very significant trickle-down effect.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about competitive markets. So when we get into situations where activity levels become low, you know, there's different strategies that companies take. You know, some companies, for example, some of the multinationals that are large companies that have lots of different revenue lines and geographic locations can take the strategy to reduce their price to maintain market share, even though there's a downturn. And at times they could even work at a loss, and they can do that because, you know, they have revenue coming from other businesses. So this isn't dishonest or unscrupulous, but sometimes that's what happens in order to keep market share. Do you think that's occurring in this downturn as well?
Yeah, most certainly it is. The goal today is to drive utilization for your manned asset base, and companies that have multiple levers to pull to assist with that are pulling them. And if you think about the genesis of STEP, it really was a reflection of sort of that mentality where the coil tubing business was dominantly controlled by the asset base in Canada was controlled by the pressure pumpers. And they were tending to put a lot less focus on profitability on the coil tubing side, not investing in that segment, using it somewhat as a loss leader to drive their frac business. And that is where the opportunity emerged for Step 2 to become a viable competitor in the market.
Because you could offer a better level of service than what they were offering.
New equipment, new technology, and certainly a stronger focus on client service in that specific segment of the market.
Mm-hmm. So when you think about that sort of situation where some companies are working at a loss because they have the balance sheets and they have other sources of revenue to be able to do that, if that goes on for a long time, what are the implications of that for the base in here in Western Canada?
Well, I first of all, I think the longer it lasts, the more economic realities creep into the equation. So the finance groups in these companies start to look at where they're making and losing money. And at some point, there's capitulation where they go, we've got to stop doing this. So then you start to see rationalization of businesses. So maybe businesses shut down. There's certain segments of these larger companies that close. You know, maybe the focus in one geography changes because there's a better return in a different area. So I think the long-term impact is specific to Canada is that Canada loses the capacity of the service industry to be able to respond to a higher activity level when that occurs.
I want to get back to this notion of productivity and innovation. And I know you and I have talked about this offline a lot. I want to understand the implications of this very, very competitive, tight market on innovation, because it's a very Darwinian out there, right? Like survival of the fittest, strong mm-hmm. get stronger, weak get weaker. You just painted a picture where not everybody's going to survive.
Right.
And those that do survive are the leanest and meanest and fittest. Are they getting even more lean, mean, and fit?
There's no question. I mean, if I could just be specific about STEP, what we've accomplished through efficiencies and discrete focuses on certain parts of our business in last year has really been remarkable. It's something I'm incredibly proud of. And that catalyst was created by this ongoing downturn. So we and our peers are investing in digital technologies. We're investing in field technologies that make our equipment last longer, that allow us to get the job done quicker and more reliably. So there is a tremendous transition going on, and it brings us back to that earlier point where we are becoming more efficient, we're getting more done with less equipment, and effectively continuing to inflate the available capacity in the market.
So that's a positive implication, and that's we had a step change in productivity in that 14 or 15, 16 period. Now we're having another one. So the companies are becoming more resilient. But there is another, I think, dynamic here going on is that because of these very competitive prices, you know, those big multinationals do have an advantage right now to keep their market share, where others that don't have that are forced to work at, you know, very low prices for the work that they do. And could that result in a shrinking capacity of Canadian companies here in Western Canada and more bigger market share for some of the multinationals?
Yeah, certainly that probably is in fact happening to some degree in Canada already. But the point is, we need to be very mindful as an industry that the homegrown Canadian businesses need to find a way to make it through this cycle so that they can be there to support their clients, the E&P companies, as the business recovers. I think our clients are very, very aware that they would not want to be beholden to the large multinationals in a recovery without some very healthy competition, because they'll know then what will happen to their pricing structure. It is sort of something I think our clients need to be very mindful of, is ensuring that they are doing their best to support Canadian companies to ensure they remain viable and healthy.
Yeah, and here's a specific example. Like Schlumberger talked about in their last quarterly result that they are going to do a strategic assessment of their American land strategy, and they may decide to reduce portfolio in one or multiple basins. So you could have a situation here where big multinationals, you know, have become a bigger part of the market share. They exit because someone up in headquarters says this isn't profitable. And now the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin has a lot less capacity and a lot less companies to serve the industry.
Absolutely. And I think what we perhaps need to be a bit mindful of with this current cycle is the capital markets are closed, the debt markets are closed. So the ability of the remaining service companies in Canada to respond to add capacity might be restricted. And it could really compound into an extended environment where our clients can access services and pricing inflation could be quite material.
But what about the idea that Canadian oil and gas companies should be supporting more homegrown local companies like you? The whole buy local thing, whether it's your vegetables or your oil field supplies.
I do think that that is a trend that we're becoming more mindful of in all sorts of our procurement on a personal level and a business level. Certainly from our point of view, we are looking to support Canadian suppliers that support our business so that that supply chain will be available mm-hmm. when we need it. And I can say that there is some oil companies, one being Tourmaline, that published last year very proudly that they awarded their frac business to just Canadian suppliers specifically. So it's great to see that level of awareness. And certainly, again, we need to be thinking beyond sort of today's environment to when it does get busier and how the business is going to be able to support our clients.
It's an interesting dynamic that is falling out of all this really difficult times and transition is that the Canadian oil and gas industry, whether it's the producers or the service companies, are becoming much more self-sustaining, self-sufficient in a sense, self-sustaining in capital, self-sustaining mm-hmm. in their own ecosystem, innovating, and so on. And I think that speaks to a leaner and meaner company going forward. You know, having said that, we don't want to diminish the acute transitional pain, especially some of the social consequences that we talked about earlier mm-hmm. with what goes on in the small towns. But ultimately, it could argue for a stronger industry that's more resilient to lower price and so on.
These environments do create durability. They do create resilience for the companies that are fortunate enough to make it through. And we do compete on a global scale for our clients do for their product in the market. And cost is a relentless focus that we can never lose sight of. And you know, certainly this downturn is driving cost efficiencies that perhaps even 2 years ago, we couldn't even have imagined.
Yeah. Is that any different in any other business?
I can't imagine it is.
No, it isn't. Yeah, I always say that, you know, some of these companies, I don't know, call it Apple, call it whatever, they don't sit around the boardroom table saying, when's the price of iPhones going up? Like, you know, it's a very cost competitive business. And I think it's interesting that we didn't talk about that at all in this interview, that, we just got to wait for the price of oil or gas to go up. We've been talking about the measures you're taking to become much more resilient going forward.
Yeah. I use the phrase, I think the oil and gas industry is becoming a very honest business. Hmm. So in the absence of access to capital and debt to sort of camouflage what actually the financial performance can be of a business, it's becoming incredibly transparent. You either are viable and you either do make a return based on the assets you have and the business you run, or you don't. And I think that that is, in the long run, a very, very healthy thing for the business. It's just incredibly painful to have to go through.
Well, thank you, Regan, for joining us. Difficult times. 2019 was not great, and next year could be similar. So we just want to remind everyone in our listener community to think about the oil field service capacity here in Western Canada. Think about hiring local Canadian suppliers to ensure depth of capacity in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Regan, for joining us.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thanks.
And thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.